This is the Bruce Poinsett Show, the world's most dangerous infomercial. And along with my producer, Ado, we bring you this bi-weekly news, interviews, and commentary experience. We give you this news live on Twitch, and we give you the show every second and fourth Wednesday at 7 p.m. on The Numbers FM. You can also catch clips on youtube.com/BrucePoinsett and exclusive content by becoming a member at patreon.com/BrucePoinsett. But again, we begin every show with news stories you might have missed, but should definitely be on your radar. So now, without further ado, the news. First story comes from Coin6, and it is PPS, Cleveland High School vandalized with racist hate language and graffiti. Now, according to the article, in a message sent to families, Joanne Watkins, the school's principal, said that the school was spray painted on the front doors, windows along the first door, the gym doors facing Southeast Franklin, and the gym doors facing Southeast 28th over the weekend. The stadium benches, turf, and track were also spray painted. Individuals associated with Cleveland in the past had their names spelled out, said Watkins in the message obtained by Coin6 News. A swastika was painted on the left front door. Students' safety and inclusion is the district's core value. Hate is not tolerated nor accepted in our community. Meanwhile, white people are still terrorizing school board meetings over critical race theory. For our next story, we go to Willamette Week. It's titled, Threat to Abortion Rights Reaches Oregon's Border After Idaho Passes quote-unquote heartbeat bill, by Tess Risky. So, quick background from the article. The Idaho legislature on March 14th passed a so-called heartbeat bill that closely mirrors an abortion ban by the same name in Texas that the U.S. Supreme Court refused to block following a 5-4 vote in September. Idaho's bill prohibits abortion of a preborn child once a fetal heartbeat has been detected, usually around 6 weeks into a pregnancy when the embryo is the size of a pomegranate seed. Furthermore, the bill states that any female upon whom an abortion has been attempted or performed, the father of the preborn child, a grandparent, sibling, aunt, or uncle may sue the medical provider for up to $20,000 in damages. Unlike the Texas law, Idaho's does carve out an exception for pregnancies that result from incest or rape, with the caveat that the person seeking an abortion must have filed a police report before terminating the pregnancy and that they must share the report with the abortion provider. So, obviously, it's pretty bleak. But just another thing from the article to bring it back to Oregon. On the heels of Idaho's bill passage, Oregon lawmakers on March 15th announced the $15 million Oregon Reproductive Health Equity Fund, approved in the session's final budget bill, which will address immediate and urgent patient needs for abortion funds and practical support like traveling and lodging. So, a little bit of a bright side to, again, a bleak story and a series of bleak stories going on across the country for a real threat to, not just a threat, but a realized danger to reproductive rights. And I think this really highlights how even in states like ours in Oregon, where, you know, abortion is legal, it's still affected by these states, because you have people, whether it's flying in from Texas, whether it's driving over from Idaho, who need this care, and it does put a strain on resources. It does put a strain on all the other things, as mentioned in the article, whether you're talking about travel and lodging and how you make that happen, just so people, again, can get the health care they need. So, you know, we're in really scary times for reproductive rights, but, you know, keep staying tuned, keep paying attention, stay vigilant. The next story comes from OPB. It's titled by Cassandra Profita. It's titled, Portland Clean Energy Fund Program is Still Missing Key Pieces, Audit Finds. So, a couple excerpts from the article. First, in the report, auditors said the Portland Clean Energy Fund is missing key elements of the plan 65% of voters approved in 2018. For example, it doesn't even have the essential climate change goals the program is supposed to be helping the city achieve. Auditors flagged multiple structural problems, including a lack of oversight and accountability systems, unpredictable revenue, and unclear administrative costs that could prevent the program from meeting the requirements outlined in its underpinning legislation. As of last year, the resulting 1% tax on large retailers had generated more than $185 million, a lot more revenue than expected. The program was predicted to generate $44 million to $61 million a year. In the last fiscal year, revenues reached $116 million. So we're going to get into a couple more thoughts from this article, but I think a lot of people's initial reaction when they see this, especially the headline, is raise alarm, or is climate change a fraud? What are we going to do? But that brings me back to the article in which one of the auditors mentions, and let me bring it back. Caballero said the good news is the city council can fix problems with the program. What you're seeing is something that should be expected, she said. When something is brought into the code through an initiative petition, it's not going through the normal checks and balances. It's a startup that's just getting underway. I think that framing is very key here, because a lot of these initiatives to actually bring radical change, especially when they also come with components that center marginalized people, they are effectively in the wild, wild west of the process. They're trying to build something from nothing. Now, the fact that the revenues were much more than expected is already a good sign. And there's also a letter from, I believe, some Portland businesses earlier this week trying to jump on this auditor's report. However, as some, including Commissioner Joanne Hardesty, pointed out, that could very much also be a sign of these businesses wanting to not pay as much money into this and not invest as much, and taking advantage of this audit and the headlines to do so. So again, stay vigilant, stay aware that this is a process, and don't let these forces stop us from continuing to pursue these needed structural changes. So our next article also comes from OPB. It's titled by Rebecca Ellis, and it's titled, Portland Leaders Reconsidering Arrangement Between Downtown Service District and Police. So according to Ellis, Portland leaders say they will slowly phase out a controversial arrangement between the Police Bureau and Downtown Clean and Safe, a nonprofit that provides extra cleaning and security services in the city center. Since 1997, the nonprofit has hired Portland Police to patrol the Enhanced Services District, one of three zones in the city in which property owners pay a fee to get better services than what the city supplies. Under the agreement, four police officers on bikes are assigned to patrol the 213 block radius. Businesses that pay into the district receive a faster police response as a result. Further down the article, the thorny issue was left unresolved during last year's contentious vote by a Portland City Council to renew the city's contract with Downtown Clean and Safe. That $25 million deal committed the nonprofit to overseeing the Enhanced Services District for another 5 years, but left many of the most controversial aspects of the arrangement unchanged, including the district's reliance on private security and city police officers. With a separate agreement between Downtown Clean and Safe, the Police Bureau expiring at the end of June, city leaders have been quietly re-examining the relationship. On Wednesday, City Council will consider a new four-year contract between the two entities that would eventually see Downtown Clean and Safe sever its relationship with the Police Bureau. Furthermore, in the article, by phasing out funding from Clean and Safe to the PPB, it is now ensuring that the public will be funding private interests entirely for the exact same role they were serving before, organizers with Stop the Sweeps, an advocacy group that rallied against renewing the district last year, wrote in a statement. Their statement continues, now all community members of Portland will be forced to opt in to Clean and Safe via this contract and forced to pay for security services that may disagree with and have terrible outcomes as evidenced by the state of downtown. So I think that statement from Stop the Sweeps is especially important, because what we're really talking about here is people who are paid by, you know, Portland tax dollars, but their authority is to private businesses to deal with the issues downtown, primarily homelessness. So if it's under the jurisdiction essentially of the businesses there who've, you know, if you've seen the Portland Business Alliance, are not very shy about the idea of sweeping out homeless people with nothing else, just cold sweeping, you really, one, don't want people with guns and badges having even more power to do that. Never mind, again, not being under the control of even the city, but under the control of private entities to do that. So we'll stay tuned to this story, keep an eye out on that. But again, the intersections of the police and the, you know, mass incarceration whole infrastructure and just our regular lives, whether we know we're opting in or not, are always there. And the work to dismantle those systems is vast. And that's the news for this week. The Bruce Poinsett Show will be back after this quick commercial break. The Bruce Poinsett Show is made possible by the support of members at patreon.com/brucepoinsett. Patreon is a service that allows you to directly support creators like myself through monthly or annual memberships. Become a member for as little as $3 a month and get access to exclusive bonus clips and live discussions. Check out this clip from the page.
Are you defending the prequels? Where does your defense end, Bruce?
So, you know what? Maybe this might surprise you, but yeah, the whole meal deal. I will defend the prequels, kind of. Again, I also had a disclaimer at the beginning that I would not put money on me if I were betting on this as a viewer, but will I defend the prequels? Yes. If you enjoy this content and believe in the community I'm trying to build, please support by becoming a member at patreon.com/brucepoinsett. Welcome back to the Bruce Poinsett Show. I got a special guest, man, to my right here, the man behind it all, Mr. DJ Ambush.
Man, it's a pleasure to be here. I've been watching this show from the rafters, you know, from some low-lit areas. Some might call them caves. Caves where bats dwell. And it's been really, really good. It's been really cool. It's been amazing. It's been a great show. I'm honored to be involved.
Yeah, I'm happy to have you here. That may or may not change in like 2 minutes. But
oh, this is gonna be a messy one.
This is gonna be another ongoing segment, the Blurtastic Adventure. If you're familiar with my other show, which goes on the numbers every 7 p.m. every first and third Wednesday, the Blacktastic Adventure. It's a little spinoff. But basically something magic has happened in some of the pre-production processes we've been through here, where I'm in the studio, ADO's in the studio, Ambush is in the studio. And for those who are unfamiliar, we like nerd stuff. We really do. So there's some very epic,
unapologetically,
some very epic, blurty conversations. And with the recent release of The Batman, we had to talk about it. But first, to get the controversial point out of the way and set the table, because we're going to talk about our general thoughts about the movie, but I have a general theory on Batman. Keep in mind, this is one of my favorite characters. But also, if you want to understand the construct of the white man in America, study Batman. It is a masterclass in just the way, like, the white man approaches problem solving. you have this billionaire who could solve all the problems in Gotham with the money, and he does a little bit of philanthropy here and there to keep a low profile, but instead he dresses up at night, spends God knows how much money on military grade gadgets, and beats up mostly poor henchmen just trying to get by in a city that he also happens to be starving of resources.
Wow. Incendiary.
But, you know, we'll get back to the Batman theory in a bit. You know, let's start off on the niceties. Like, Ado, Ambush, what did you think about the movie?
Well, we waited quite some time for it. There was a lot of buildup. A lot of teasers, a lot of leaks. I'm gonna be honest, I got tired. I got kind of teaser and leak fatigue. But when the trailer started dropping, like, I didn't sit through DC fandom to see all the kind, I'm not doing that. But when the trailer started dropping, I really started seeing what the picture was gonna be like. oh yeah, I got amped right back up. And then I did see opening weekend. Me and MJ went to go see it. We caught an 11 o'clock show on a Sunday morning at Lloyd Center. And maybe 30 people in the theater. So, I mean, I don't want to say it's safe to go back to theaters. Everyone go rushing in because then you'll make it unsafe for me. But just know if you are one of these people where it's like, I got to see this in the theater, there are opportunities to be really selective and make sure your experience is a lot, you know, safer than you would anticipate. I wish I would have been able to see Dune in the theater, Tenet in the theater, things like that. Mm-hmm. But no, this was amazing. I remember directly after seeing it telling Ado that this was a film for Batman fans. Did it need to be 3 hours if you're not a Batman fan? No. But for us Batman fans, it could have been 6 hours because the way Matt Reeves pulled from comic books, graphic novels, cartoons, previous films, like the way he weaved so much of Batman's storyline and the mythology and the mythos into this one world that he created, which happens to be on Earth 2, is amazing. It was amazing. You were just seeing so many different Easter eggs and just different nods to everything that is, you know, Gotham and the Batman. Like, prime example, when we were introduced to the Batmobile, the roar of that engine and just the way that it was just like, okay, it is time. Mm-hmm. It's go time. Yeah, it's great. I love the film. I loved it. Ready to go see it again.
I left the movie very pleased. I think Ambush made a lot of very good points. This is a movie for Batman fans. It's also a crime film, which I really appreciate, which I feel like we haven't gotten from Batman. Yeah. Like as often, I feel like it's a mystery. I think if you're going in, everyone knows who the Riddler is and like what the Riddler is doing. But I think seeing Batman be able to solve the mysteries of the Riddler was really interesting and really cool. I don't know if we're supposed to be talking about spoilers.
Oh yeah. Okay, yeah. Cool. There will be spoilers in this conversation.
Yeah. Great. If you haven't seen the movie, don't watch an analysis of
it. Yeah. We need the Bruce review.
First off, because I feel like I've come off as the anti-Batman person here when it's like I love the character and all its messiness. All his just like his terribleness just draws me in. I can't look away. Like,
damn.
Son. But to the film, I too enjoyed the film. Maybe 2.5 hours would have been tighter for me.
Okay.
But, you know, I love just like the intro of Robert Pattinson's Batman, where he's we have all these criminals around the city just like looking around, looking in these like dark shadows. Oh my goodness. And then you get, like, I give the score a lot of credit.
Oh, just yeah.
Because when he's actually coming, you get the music. It's just like, especially that beginning where it's like, boots really loud.
Oh, yeah.
Score in the background. It's like, oh, I was about to curse. But, yeah, I was like, oh, this is right. This is right. But that brings me back to, while we're still talking about the movie, first off, I do want to get your all's opinion on the Riddler here, because you know, I'm kind of in the middle. Like on one hand, like because the Riddler's whole sort of like thesis for this is like, oh, Batman, there's a moment a lot of people, I think, kind of went over their heads where it sounded like he had figured Batman out, but he actually
which
didn't.
Is done very purposefully. That was awesome. That was amazing. We too were confused. We were like, oh no.
I give Matt Reeves a lot of credit for that shot because like, it kind of got me.
That was great.
But, you know, his whole thing is like he's trying to go after Bruce Wayne because Bruce Wayne was an orphan, but he was a billionaire orphan. Mm-hmm. It wasn't Riddler was also an orphan, and you know what he didn't get? Any of the things Bruce Wayne got. In fact, the whole an energy deal? A big, you know, government energy deal. Basically, when, you know, Thomas and Martha Wayne were killed, all that money ended up getting pillaged and, you know, stolen from within by like these mob figures and didn't go to, you know, the same orphanages that the Wayne family was responsible for funding, creating the Riddler, just like Batman somehow creates his villains.
Hey, 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 I think we're putting too much on the bat there. As far as, I mean, I feel like Gotham creates those villains, huh?
If we want to take, for example, the Killing Joke as the Joker's origin, Batman did throw the Joker in the Ace Chemicals. That was Batman.
Fine.
I'll give Gotham Two-Face. That's a Gotham creation.
Scarecrow.
Scarecrow.
Arkham creation.
Arkham creation, yes. I would say Batman, though, intensifies his
Absolutely. Yes, he allows street thugs. He gives them a reason to rise to the occasion and become so much more than they should be. I absolutely agree with that. I will take a second to mention, I do appreciate the consistency in the Wayne's underfunding orphanages. This did happen. This did happen in Chris Nolan's Batman. They just be like, "We'll set it up," and but they always end up turning Wayne Manor into an, turning into an orphanage.
Okay, but so you just said like things are a creation of Gotham, right? Okay, in this movie, what I liked about this movie, in addition to the other things, is that I feel like it's the most self-aware Batman movie
I've seen
in a while.
Absolutely.
Like, they even point out, you know who basically runs the town? The Waynes and the Arkhams.
And the Arkhams. Yes.
Oh, let's see. This villain is a creation of Arkham. This villain is a creation of the lack of money in the orphanage. So who's responsible for the problems in Gotham? It seems to be these two families that run everything.
I just feel like that's a heavy statement to make, as if before these families, Gotham wasn't Gotham.
Let's talk about Batman some more. Because you brought up the Nolan movies. We brought the Court of Owls.
Some comic book references.
Brought up the comic book. So let's talk about the character as a whole. And let's really get into this whole, this theory of mine that still I feel like checks out here. We haven't really... Just because you're like, well, Batman is just a part of the problem. He's not the whole problem. Okay. Thank you. Donald Trump had parents too.
Wow.
Ding, 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 ding.
But no. Okay. Yeah. First off, Batman, let's just be real. Again, I've said, I think Batman is an enduring, engaging character. He inspires in us that spirit of wanting to right the wrongs when no one else will. I get that. It's very, he's brooding and stuff, and we all kind of like...
We have those moments.
Mm-hmm. We don't necessarily go to therapy as much as we should. Right. Batman doesn't ever, which, again, I feel like is a big issue here that could have solved a lot of things, but oh well. Wouldn't make for great movies. That said, we also have to look at the things we don't even question with Batman. Like, creating villains, as we've all established here, is one thing. But also, he takes on child soldiers. Repeatedly.
You got there so quick.
Robin.
The next Robin.
I thought the next Robin.
No. Jason Todd, the second Robin. Ooh. Not just, what happens to that child soldier? Oh, he's murdered by one of Batman's villains.
Oh.
And is that a time to stop and reflect and be like, yo, maybe this is a bad idea. Nah.
There's a lot.
Let me get another Robin. Let me get a Batgirl too.
Spiral.
You know? Oh, and why don't I have another son with my villain's daughter?
We gotta be careful there, because Batman definitely was drugged by Talia.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. But
yeah, it was involuntary.
Yeah.
Damian is the boss, though.
But Damian. Oh, why don't I bring him into this too? Because,
he did.
I'll give him credit. He could have just done it with random children, but he was like, nah, I'm going to bring my own blood into this too. I don't discriminate. So
he could have taken another
good
child
on Batman there for really just, again, continuously employing child soldiers, scouting child soldiers, grooming child soldiers, and us all just being like, this is great. This is wonderful. Why would we ever question this? This seems like a great guy.
You know what? I had no defense for that. Listen, okay, I have no defense for that. I'm not saying, okay, is Batman the solution? No. Is he fun? Hell yeah.
I'd argue Matt Reeves actually not just made my point, but like, think about it. The Riddler is the main villain, right?
Yes.
And the Riddler was effectively thinking, one, that all this time they were partnering together, which was an interesting thing. And the one moment in the film where I'm like, this Riddler tantrum is a little weird. But
he was like, no. Like, what do you mean, bro?
Yeah, I kind of got a little Darth Vader Revenge of the Sith. But I digress. But the Riddler is copying Batman, and the Riddler's followers, they're not just like, yeah, they're kind of copying the Riddler, but they're copying Batman because they're literally like, I am vengeance.
Yes.
It's like, Again, I'll give you Batman is part of the problem.
Yeah.
I'll give you that. He's not responsible for all the problems. But when you're out here talking about I am the shadows, having people just looking around in random places.
Oh, yeah.
And then you're like, I am vengeance.
That's right.
And then
more of that.
And then the people terrorizing the city are like, I am vengeance. One plus one. I feel like it equals two at that point.
I mean, it's not a perfect plan, you know?
Really?
It's a work. His strategy's a work in progress, you know?
He's changing his ways.
And by the end of the movie, what happens? He realizes vengeance isn't the way to go.
Yeah, but also, because we know where this is going, and I'd like to, again, he's like, vengeance isn't the way to go, but he is on the path. We have not gotten to the child soldiers yet. That is coming. Hey, have I not brought you over to my side after all this?
I feel like I was with you from the get. I love Batman. I'm a proud Batmaner. I'm proud to be on the side of, hey, like, Batman can solve any crime. He can do anything.
It's true.
But I can fully acknowledge, especially after watching The Batman, Bruce Wayne is kind of ignorant and kind of like put himself in a lot of positions. Like, he hasn't gone outside in a while.
Yeah. Like, he doesn't know what daytime looks like.
Yeah.
Well, plot twist. I was always on the... We were always aligned. There was never a time, like, in all seriousness. No. He's a billionaire in an under-resourced city. He's not a millionaire. He's a billionaire in an under-resourced city. Yeah. Sure. We just, in what we saw in Matt Reeves, the Batman, Alfred saying, you need to spend some daytime hours actually running your company, your billion-dollar legacy company. No, I belong to the night. Nah, that's probably not the best move at this point. I'm pretty sure you backing the right politicians, councilmen and women, aldermen, like, there's things you could do. And again, we did see that in The Dark Knight with him wanting to retire and back Harvey. So there are opportunities here where some of these writers and directors are like, even Bruce does see, you know, and that was a much older Bruce too. Bruce does see that he doesn't really want to be doing this. He doesn't really want to do this mess full time. But this younger Bruce of course, he hasn't gotten there yet.
Right.
But I mean, just the fact that, like you were saying, does he go outside? Does he have healthy relationships? Does he even know what, you know, it looks like to be a billionaire playboy? Nope, not yet. Not at all. That's really the James Bond side to this for him. Like, there's so many things that he can do. Imagine employing those exact same strategies in the daytime with all of the money possible. Yeah, he could turn Gotham around in 5 years.
Yeah, and with that, just like to, again, close this out with, now that we all agree that Batman is just an unforgivable fascist, let's keep watching these films.
Yeah. See y'all for the Batman 2.
Oh, man. The Bruce Poinsett Show will be back after this quick ad break. BrucePointsett.com is your one-stop shop for everything Bruce Poinsett. You have my services such as freelance writing and editing, creative nonfiction courses, as well as customized writing classes, event facilitation, and digital content creation. Again, go to BrucePointsett.com for a quote and make sure to sign up for our newsletter so you don't miss any news or updates. Welcome back to exclusive newsletter interviews. I'm Bruce Poinsett, and I got not just a special, maybe a familiar guest to some of you, but familiar guest with a new name, Mr. Donovan Scribes. How are you doing, Donovan?
I'm doing good. I'm doing real good. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, yeah. So it's not just that you changed your name, but also that, you know, you recently put out an op-ed for Street Roots titled "Why Scribes: The Long Ancestral Journey That Led Me to Change My Name." It's really just a really, you know, deep personal piece. And, you know, I think, you know, some people might think, oh, so what's the big deal about a name change? But like, you really get into it. You really get into the family history, you know, just your experience coming up, whether it be, you know, in Portland, going to OES, going to Fisk, coming back into town. You even drop some news about a new addition to your family. And we're gonna get into all of that. But just to start it off, you know, can you just, again, I highly encourage people to read the whole essay, but I guess can you just like briefly summarize why this name change was so important to you?
I mean, it was a couple things that really led me to, well, there are many things, but two kind of key things. One is, you know, my name, Donovan Smith. Donovan Mickey Smith is my full name, but Donovan Smith. Smith is my dad's last name. And for me, I did not grow up with my dad as like a key fixture in my life. And the way he had treated my mom in particular, the stories that I have of how he was were terrible, you know? And so he's got all these kids that are around the country, literally. And most of them are Smiths just by nature of him being a man, really, and just people passing on the man's last name, really without a whole lot of question around that. But on a larger level, you know, Smith is literally like one of the most kind of like plain names when you think about it. Like John Smith is the name that you might put just to have the most plain or blank name, anonymous person. And once you really start thinking about why names like that are considered to be the norm or de facto, you really start getting into way deeper, you know, institutions and histories and things like that. And so it's been something that's swirled in my mind for a while, like how do we name things? How do we call things? How do we, you know, honor ourselves? And I guess like a decade ago, I kind of come into making the leap of like, I'm not gonna carry Smith anymore, but it was even more than that. It was like, I'm not carrying any of these like Anglo based names. Like we just, a lot of Black people, I don't have a percentage point on it, but a lot of Black people just have names that are rooted in Eurocentric names. And that is because at the base of it, because of colonialism. And we don't keep a lot of our heritage in that way. We just kind of have passed on these names from generation to generation. And what I tried to capture in the article is like, I have landed in still calling myself Donovan Scribe. So, you know, I'm still taking names that are rooted in, you know, Anglo etymology, but I think you can still have pride in your name, but I think it should at least be like questioned why we carry on these traditions and of Eurocentric names, and we should at least think about it, you know, it's at least worth thinking about. So I'm not asking every Black person to go and change their name to something Swahili, but it's something to consider. Yeah.
Yeah. So with scribes, because again, the article you discuss at one point trying to has changed every aspect of your name, and then eventually, like you said, coming back to Donovan, but you know, and you had your mom had a particular reaction to that, which again we'll get to. But let's just talk about scribes just for a minute. Like, how and why did you land on scribes?
I mean, at that particular moment, which was like 10 years ago, that I was going to change my full name. It's going to change the last name from Smith to Scribes because it was something that I was finding a lot of pride in, which is being a writer, you know, and it was something that really for a good deal of my life, I've just been like encouraged in, even if it wasn't like something that I was like deeply, like I could cite every writer and every poet and things like that. But even when I was in high school, I would have teachers running up to me and telling me how good this piece was that I wrote. And, you know, when I finally kind of moved towards like, all right, this is going to be a career choice for me, it was something that I felt even more confident in. Like, you know, I am a writer. I feel this on a deep level. But it also is like about telling, you know, being able to write our own stories, you know, for me, of like moving from Smith to Scribes is about writing our own stories, holding our own narratives, and being able to, you know, control those things. And so I feel like by giving Scribes to myself and giving it to, you know, I don't want to get ahead, but like giving it to my kid is something that she'll be able to like start her own, she'll be able to have scribes as part of a tree that is rooted in the stories that I've set a foundation for now, you know. There, when I had originally been looking at it though, at the time, I believed that there were literally no surnames of scribes. Like I had looked and I just could not find anything that said scribes as a last name. And so my belief at that time was like, oh, this is literally a place where nobody has this. And that attracted me even more to it. I did find later that there were like small pockets of people who had called themselves scribes. And I wish I had more kind of detail on them, but it is not like this long lineage of people. It seems like a kind of smaller group. And for me, I've like put a stamp in terms of like how I'm defining scribes and how I'm giving it to my tree. So that's kind of what it is for me. Yeah.
And so you said you didn't want to skip ahead, but I mean, you mentioned the baby. So we gotta go there. You also in this article announced that, you know, you and your partner are expecting, and you know, first off, congratulations. I know I've told you in other settings, but you know, officially just congratulations. And you know, one, just because again, between getting into the stuff with your parents and you know, making this announcement, it's a very personal piece. And I know with my own, just I know when I'm writing sometimes, especially when I'm, you know, making kind of like breaking news, for lack of better terms, to the public about myself, like putting it out, you know, publishing it can feel like, you know, it's just like, it gets like a weight off of you, right? Like, did you have some of that similar experience? Like, what was that feeling for you to like, again, just like share these things, like in such like a public setting?
I mean, I had a lot of different anxieties and excitement going into it, you know, and I really haven't had anything that quite goes here in terms of a personal level. So you know, I've definitely never like discussed my dad in public. And so it was one of those things where I was talking to my mom at length before this piece came out. I, you know, spoke to my aunt who's mentioned in the article, and spoke with my her mom, my grandma before. And I ended up even, you know, my mom encouraged me to speak with my dad. So I even spoke with him before the piece came out, because at first I wasn't going to do that. But, you know, I went ahead and gave him a heads up a couple of days before and let him read the piece. And, you know, it was rooting for me in that way of like, all right, I have, you know, done my part by like giving everybody who's, you know, a core part of this article a chance to digest it before it's out to the public, so I'm not getting any weird, you know, aftershocks from fam. But you know, it's really just, I felt like I was giving a lot more of myself to people, and I've been pleasantly, I can't even really say surprised, but the reception has been very warm to like what I put out there. And yeah, I knew while I was sitting there crafting it, I was just trying to craft something that I could be proud of, and you know, my daughter could be proud of too when she's old enough that she can like really take this in and know that like I didn't do this in haste. Like I originally was gonna do it with a whole lot of haste. Like it was like a boom, 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 I'm changing my name, like, and going to the courthouse and like just not really, really sitting with everything. And I'm like super happy that I did not do that, because it wasn't the right time. If I would have changed my name 10 years ago, I would have made a mistake. I would not have felt right. And honestly, you know, I published that essay at the same time Talilo, my friend Talilo, was on the cover of the Street Roots, and I was like, man, this is like kind of crazy for a reason that people won't even know. But like Talilo was the one that dropped me at the courthouse originally when I was going to change my name, and he was like, he said like, all right, Asani, and that whole thing did not fully feel right when he had said it, you know, said it to me. Asani was the name I was gonna change my name to. But yeah, I'm mostly just glad that I have sat with it and that I was able to like really hone in and spill my kind of vulnerability onto a page, and that people are taking it and, you know, like living with it. And, you know, like I just got a message the other day. Somebody said it gave them like the encouragement to change their name, you know, and it's like, that was really kind of like, whoa, you know. But yeah, it's felt good. It feels like a thing that I want to continue talking about too. Like, I don't want this piece to just live like within this moment. Like, I think it's something that we have to keep peeling through in terms of like, what are our names? Why do we call ourselves this? And, you know, just honor of Black names and people outside of just the confines of what's your name, but how we honor Black people in public. So that's kind of where I'm hoping to take the conversation beyond this piece.
Right. So yeah, so no one's been giving you the, your mama named you Smith, so I'm gonna call you Smith. All right, none of that.
not yet. You know, in terms of my fam, like Scribes, is like, it's been really tight. Like people saying or texting to me like Mr. Scribes, you know, I was at the DMV just the other day too, and the guy was like, you know, I had my name changed for him, and it's like, Mr. Scribes, it's just like, it's felt affirming that like people have taken to it. I did have a lot of anxiety around that when I originally was going to change my name though, like that Asani would not be honored like as my chosen name. And I think it would have been more of a challenge if I had changed from my given name to that. I think it comes with a whole lot of other stuff where people do the, your mom called you this, so I'm gonna call you this type of stuff. I think it's maybe in some ways more risky to change your first name than your surname, but your surname also is like the thing that gets passed on. So
speaking of that, you know, again, you talked about the article initially when you told your mom you were trying to change your name, you know, she wasn't really warm to it, but I'm curious, like, you know, if you are in a place to share, like, I'm curious how she feels about it now, or what those conversations have been like.
She's been extremely encouraging, you know, with this. She gets the reasons. You know, I think, you know, in the article I talk about how my dad got my middle and last name. And so Donovan was something that she like really took a lot of time with and spent a lot of time thinking about something that felt unique. And so changing that felt like losing a part of her, you know, and our bond. And, you know, and so it just, I still had went to the courthouse to change my name at that time, but I'm very grateful I didn't, you know, ultimately do that. And I think in terms of why I wanted to change from Smith to Scribes, you know, whether it's the relationship with my dad or relationship to, you know, slavery, all these things are things she's understood. And like when I took my DNA test this past summer, you know, I was sitting in the house with her and we're like finding new stuff out about our ancestors on her side, and like her dad had told her stuff about Panola County, Texas, but it's like we were learning together what was really going on down there, and it was like the slave county in Texas, and you know, seeing Ballard trace back that far to like the 1800s and everything. I think it's been something that she's been sitting with herself. Like we have gone back and forth over trying to find out if we can connect where this Ballard, you know, cause she's a Ballard last name, came from, you know? And so it's something that, yeah, she's given me a lot of love. She's, you know, called me Mr. Scribe several times, and I think it feels the best coming from her. She understands it all, and you know, even if she doesn't understand all of it, she understands mostly where I'm coming from. And yes, given nothing but encouragement. And you know, the day I sent the day leading up to sending it out, she was giving me more affirmation that I'm doing the right thing when it came out, and since, you know, has given that love. So yeah, it's felt good.
And that's a beautiful thing. You know, you've talked about wanting beyond just this piece, you know, wanting people to take it and, you know, start asking some of those questions, start having those conversations about, you know, where do these names come from? Where do we come from? What does it mean? But yeah, is there anything else you like to say either about the article or just what you want people to take away from this?
Yeah, I think, you know, I definitely wanted to release this piece during Black History Month, because it's as much about history as it is about future. You know, and I tried to capture more than name. You know, this is not just a conversation about names. If you really read through the article, you know, I didn't go as deep as I could have with what was going on with my dad, but I think there's things that he was doing and has done that are things that are happening in the community that should be talked about, you know, in terms of absenteeism and in terms of, you know, how he showed up with my mom, in terms of how he talks about himself, even, you know, as an older man. I think there's things to in there that are about class, you know. In that piece, I talk a lot about OES, you know, my experience at Oregon Episcopal and that space, and all of these things have impacted how I think about myself and how I've thought about identity. And I think all of the things I kind of wove in there are part of how we name ourselves, how we honor names in public and people and who we honor and how we honor. And I just tried to do justice by all the themes that I touched on. So I hope people read it as a conversation starter, you know, like that this is not just about me changing my name. It is a question about how we name things, you know, and how we name ourselves and what honor looks like and what it doesn't look like, you know. So yeah.
Awesome. Well, yeah, Donovan Scribes, thank you again for taking the time this afternoon, and you know, best of luck. You know, again, congratulations on the new baby on the way, and yeah, you know, try and get some rest, because yeah, I imagine there's not going to be a lot of that in your future.
It's going to be a fridge full of yerba mates pretty soon here. No. But yeah,
for sure. Thank you for watching. Please like and share and subscribe so you can stay up to date on all the latest videos. Thank you. This has been the Bruce Poinsett Show. Make sure to catch us every second and fourth Wednesday at 7 p.m. on The Numbers FM, as well as on youtube.com/Bruce Poinsett. And for exclusive clips, go to patreon.com/Bruce Poinsett and become a member. In the meantime, hey, black people, trust me, it won't hurt. See you next week.